Welcome to a History of Horror podcast, a year-long journey through films throughout the decades, examining across the globe what makes us scared. Christopher Brown. Last time when we were talking about Arabic horror and films from that area, I said sometimes it can be quite difficult to find information in terms of, you know, who owns these films or where these films have come from, or indeed, you know, kind of get a grasp of where they exist. And a lot of the reason for that is that unlike, you know, the Hollywood studio system, where there's very clear lineage for properties, certain parts of the world, there isn't as much. And that makes it more difficult. Africans' history, in terms of cinema, is a little different. It was late to the game. And there are two big drivers for the industry now in the continent. Now, last week I also said that I felt that it was, you know, almost patronising to kind of cover an entire continent of film in one go. What we're going to do is kind of pinpoint certain areas and kind of give you a feel. So to say this isn't going to be definitive would be a bit of an understatement, but at the very least, it kind of gives you a tone for how cinema is. Now, African cinema, or film production anyway in Africa, date back as far as the early 20th century, like a lot of our story, when film reels were coming in and being used. But during the colonial era, Africa was represented exclusively by Western filmmakers. And so the continent was portrayed as this kind of like exotic landscape didn't really kind of give any sense of the history or the culture or what it was to be there. And in that sense, from a horror perspective, we don't get any concepts of, you know, what are the drivers for fear or any of the things that we normally touch on in terms of why these films are the way they are. So you get exactly what you'd imagine. Tarzan, you know, African Queen, and King Solomon's Mines. Those kind of boyzone adventure kind of stories, you know. So in the African colonies, for example, Africans themselves were prohibited by decree from making their own movies. And therefore, you know, it's therefore not surprising at all that film growth as a cultural element was very difficult to come by. A lot of the films from that time that did come out, for example, the short film Afrique Sur Seine from 1955, which was made by Paulin Sumararu Vera, kind of looks at how difficult it is to be a black man, an African, in Paris. And that's a reoccurring theme, probably, in the post-independence 1970s and onwards. So, for example, the first African film ready to gain international recognition was La Noire D, also known as The Black Girl, which showed an African woman's pain and struggle and despair while she was working as a maid in France. At the moment, the industry from that part of the world is dominated by two markets. Nigeria, which is one of the biggest film markets in the world, and also South Africa, which is one of those kind of countries where it is very cheap to film in, so low budget film comes out of it quite a lot, and therefore quite a lot of horror. So with Nigerian horror, let's take this concept of Nollywood. Now, the origin of the term is kind of not really been spotted. Film historian Jonathan Haynes traces the usage back to a 2002 article by Matt Steinglass in the New York Times, where it's used as a general kind of catch-all for this booming Nigerian cinema. And it's kind of an unsurprising kind of combination between the word, obviously, Nigeria and Hollywood. It's not a particularly well thought out thing in the same way Bollywood isn't, really. The industry is very big because they are able to create films very cheaply, but also because there are a huge amount of markets. So a Nollywood film as such could be anything that's been filmed in Nigeria that's in anything from English all the way through 300 different Nigerian languages, which obviously would all have their own different markets. And it kind of comes from this sense of Nigerian independence and their theatrical stage kind of culture there. But there are also parts of the world which, it kind of has been spread out to include not just Nigerian film, but elements of the Ghanaian film industry, which we'll kind of get onto and touch on in a little bit in terms of, cultural elements. But, it's effectively turning into this kind of watchword or catch-all for huge amounts of cinema that is coming out from this part of the world. So, a film that, for example, has been created outside of Nigeria that's basically been designed for a Nigerian audience could also be considered to be Nollywood, although, people in Nigeria may disagree. However, like a lot of this stuff, it's worth wearing in mind that some people in the industry there don't like the term. It smacks of colonialism and imperialism, because it's a term that they didn't come up with. It's kind of almost been thrust upon them. And it insinuates that Nigerian cinema is somehow a cheap imitation or tribute to Hollywood cinema or Bollywood cinema. And the reality is, obviously, it's not. It's from a very different place mentally. And it is an industry that grew organically. To give you some idea in terms of how much of a pain it's been to kind of research that and kind of pull up good examples of these films. Because the way that part of the world grew and because of a lack of interest, shall we say, in Western audiences for a lot of these films, it's been very difficult to kind of get any information. But also, they themselves don't really agree on the history and timeline of stuff because it's kind of happened. No one was documenting this stuff at the time. So in 2012, it was announced that Nollywood, as such, would be celebrating its 20th anniversary. Now, the year marked the release of the direct-to-video movie Living in Bondage from 1992, which kind of was like the indicator and marked what was their boom in home video, which became more than that. It kind of democratized film in their country, allowed people to record and also to see. In the same way we discussed in the 80s for viewing in the UK, to a lesser extent for filmmaking, how video kind of let people do that. And also in the US with, Chester Novel Turner, who probably wouldn't have been able to make films like Tales from the Quad Zone in the past, was able to kind of create his own horror cinema, which in themselves became cult classics. So the anniversary was actually celebrated, though, in 2013. It became clear, though, that it was kind of a part of this Nigerian film industry that agreed to do this. It'd been organised by the Association of Movie Producers, an association system, produced effectively VHS video films, direct-to-video movies. But since the fact that effectively what we had here was an anniversary for 2012 happening in 2013, it kick-started debate about what was this anniversary actually for. So you had stakeholders that said, this industry is older than 20 years, so why are you celebrating 20 years? And since Nollywood is an idea for entire film industry, Living in Bondage couldn't be used as this tentpole for the film that kick-started it all, because it didn't. It was just a very much a big film from that period. It wasn't even the first successful video film, let alone the first successful Nigerian. But what is Living in Bondage? Well, it's a drama thriller, but with some supernatural elements. So as we've said before, and I think this kind of the Arabic kind of framing is worth kind of returning to here a little bit. It's not the same, but a lot of the films that they do are more based on elements such as, you know, family dramas and that kind of thing, and, you know, there are certain elements of kitchen sink about them, but also that they are films that have maybe a supernatural element to them, or a revenge theme. So, and for example, Living in Bonds is a classic one of these kind of films, which we've spoken about, which do kind of vary throughout the world, but are still that kind of idea. So, shot straight to video, it stars the African Movie Academy Award winner Kanayo Okayo and Francis Agyew. And it's this story about a man who joins this cult, and he decides to kill his wife in a ritualistic sacrifice. And as his reward, he gains lots of money and power. But for his pains, what he's given also is a dead wife's ghost to deal with, who haunts him to try and commit revenge. The thing that's notable about it is, a film that I've just described, if it came out of Hollywood, would be below 90 minutes. Living in Bondage, partly due to the fact that it was shot on video and therefore could be, was a whopping 163 minutes long, and it is a very talky piece, if it's fair to say. Another notable would be Missing Angel from 2004, that is directed by Charles Novia. It's a big film, very popular over there, and created two sequels. So the plot deals with Dolly, a young woman who makes a vow to God that she should die on her 25th birthday. If her misery continues, a dark angel, performed by Desmond Elliott, is sent to manipulate her. But in actual fact, what happens is he slowly falls in love. So here again we have a genre mashup, a supernatural theme laid next door to a love story, a love story that shouldn't be, kind of thing, and that in itself is interesting. This kind of genre mashup. To give you some idea about the type of cultural shift that VHS and VCRs gave to parts of Africa, you can look at Ghana with their video clubs. So when it was, you know, film at certain parts of the world is obviously very expensive and very difficult to come by, even 16 mils, you know, you need the projector, you need to get the film there. VHS was cheap to produce, and it was cheap to get there, and the actual copying and dubbing of these films was also incredibly easy, so a black market could be created. So entrepreneurs set up video clubs, effectively small kind of kino cinemas that they could screen films out of for the local community. They were called video clubs with names like Ziggy and Pall Mall and Sly Fox and these kind of concepts that, you know, highlighted that the what people wanted to see possibly was exotic films from Hollywood. They would grab local artists and kind of use it to kind of fly the area to tell people that films were coming up. So these were painted on empty flour sacks and would be an artist's interpretation of the film. These posters are fantastic to look for. You should kind of hunt them out, particularly the horror ones, because they kind of give an indication of the film. They kind of say the stars, and you can kind of say, you know, Friday the 13th Part 4 involves Jason Voorhees with a mask and a knife. But kind of it's skewed for a very different kind of viewpoint. There are interpretations of films that you've probably never seen before. Now, I know there's a trend for kind of the Polish kind of old movie posters, but these themselves have a different kind of feel to them and reflect the homegrown community aspect of the film viewing, which is really exciting. These are almost cartoonish reanimations of what effectively normally are B-movies because they were mass-produced but cheap to get hold of. I kind of give a real kind of strong feel for how people could kind of, you know, make film their own and kind of, you know, make a business out of it, even though it's kind of slightly probably not what Hollywood would like, if it's being honest, kind of, you know, using their images and manipulating them in a certain way, and maybe they didn't even pay for the tape in the first place. Over in South Africa, horror films have grown mainly due to the fact that these are co-productions with other countries, if I'm being honest. This is because of tax reasons and, you know, incentives and that kind of thing. In the same way, you know, there's booms and busts. Britain's film industry itself was based a lot on the fact that Britain could make movies cheaply in the past and probably not so much now. You know, and the films vary from everything from, you know, quite intelligent, quite good made films to basically, you know, part four of a series of that you didn't know had a part three. One of the big ones probably is from 2010 with Night Drive. Night Drive is quite controversial in the sense that it follows an undercover cop who takes part in a safari tour in Africa. The group are hunted by animal poachers who've kind of turned into, you know, man is the most, the toughest kill kind of murder kind of, so something like Turkey Shoot or Death Race, that kind of the film watch, you know, film story idea. They are harvesting their organs for witchcraft. It's unsurprisingly this controversy lies in the fact that there are elements of voodoo. The lead bad guy, as it were, is called Hyena Man. He wears this kind of voodoo mask. And my knowledge of tribalism and that kind of stuff isn't great. But I'm assuming that the fact that the cast of tourists who are on the hunt are white and the aggressors are black probably was not a great... did not go down particularly well. Aside from the fact that there's all this voodoo stuff and, you know... I'm guessing it probably made people kind of a little bit uncomfortable, if I'm being honest. And that possibly is part of the reason why they did that. But nonetheless, it's an unfortunate thing. And particularly because the film itself is well made. And there are a couple of black characters in the on our hero side, as it were. But, you know, they're not great. and that's a real shame, I think. But what it does do is highlight the tensions between the two.
Why have you shut the anti-poaching unit down?
Don't run a business here. And I can't make any money if tourists are too scared to come here.
Good. They should be scared.
They are not just killing animals.
Hey,
Hyena Man.
The Hyena Man is a myth.
Oh.
we're actually here. Africa.
I spoke to Johanny, told me about your anti-poaching unit. Guess you're back on tourist duty then.
You're coming with us.
You're right.
On an attack!
Hey, wait for me!
Hi. Yeah, I got that. So what are the chances of us seeing a kill on this night job of yours?
It's going to be a long night.
What the hell is that?
Echo Charlie, this is Alfa Romeo.
Okay, so does anybody know anything about fixing engine?
And they call themselves men.
Please, just calm down, all right? There's no need to panic. If we're not back soon, the manager is going to come and fetch us.
What the hell was that?
Amazing. He's left too many dead bodies lying around. And now, these hyenas think we are next.
Lost Boys the First was also, but this is kind of a good example because it's a mixture of a US South African production. So you got Corey Feldman as Edgar Frog doing his thing, apparently. These are a couple of director video horror films that kind of came out in the disc DVD boom that we had maybe 10 years ago. And it is exactly what you'd imagine, cheap and poorly made, but worth mentioning at least. More interesting is The Bone Snatcher, which is filmed in Cape Town by Jason Wolfson. It's about a diamond mine that has a tendency to claim the life of anyone who goes inside, so kind of a haunted house, but utilising a slightly more unusual location due to the fact that it's from South Africa. So a team go and investigate, and unsurprisingly, exactly what you would imagine was happening in that situation does. And on the plus side, what it does is create a horror film based in the desert, which I think always kind of gives it a slightly more, for our eyes, an unusual feel. We're so used to kind of clunky, creaky gates and dusty houses, that to see something happening in that blazing heat and dark cool corners of a cave, I think kind of helps it quite a lot. And since we had a random Toby Hooper appearance last week, let's have another one. 1995's The Mangler, which is known as not a great film, although based on a Stephen King short story, but kind of features Robert Englund kind of killing people with his laundry machine. It was also made in South Africa. Again, utilised the fact that it was cheap, and which is not the best way to end our story here. But I think and this is again being quite a quick episode. But I think what it does do is kind of show that the industry over there, it does exist and does kind of do its own thing and make itself more so than its core parts. This Nigerian film industry that I've spoken of is the third biggest in the world, not just in terms of the number of films it produces, but the kind of money it makes as well. And that's I think is key to our story. And although from our side, none of these films really ever wash up on our doors. And for us, probably they feel slightly unusual and different and maybe not the kind of thing that we would normally enjoy. I think it's key in our journey that we acknowledge that there are cinematic worlds out there that completely exist and not only aren't something that we would normally jump on, but in actual fact, don't even care.
There's a little bit of me in that machine, and a little bit of it
accident today. The worst one I've ever seen.
Have you considered the possibility that the machine might be haunted?
That machine killed your daughter.
We all have to make sacrifices.
Human sacrifices.
A demon is a kind of electricity. Sometimes it gets out of control. People get hurt.
Three modern masters of horror have just created the ultimate machine for terror. The Mangler.
So, there you go, very short episode there. I suppose just to really kind of give you a flavour for what we've been talking about and the different, you know, smaller, you know, but big in terms of Nigeria, but how almost, you know, I think, again, colonialism has paid a big impact in terms of how these films were created and also effectively stunted the industry until further down the line. And possibly one of the reasons wherefore why they you know, they unlike a lot of countries which, you know, try and make films that will break out into Western audiences and therefore make more money, like, for example, that United Arab Emirates film with Toby Hooper directing Jin, this, not the same at all. If you want to get hold of me, please do. My email address is historyofhorrorpodcast@gmail.com. You can get on the website, historyofhorrorpodcast.com, or you can get me on Twitter @orange_monkey. We've got two to go. Next week, we kind of look at a state of where we are, I think. And I say we as probably the audience that would be listening to this in terms of horror, with on-demand, streaming, digital, also the growth in Blu-ray and for very niche markets. And also how all this will play together and probably the impact it's having on the industry at the moment. Before we finish off and kind of say goodbye and kind of maybe get our crystal ball out as well. So, until then, take care and I'll speak to you soon.